Portrait of C.S. Lewis, 1898 to 1963. An address broadcast from BBC Radio Oxford in 1971. An Englishman once wrote a letter to one of his American friends, and in it occur these words: "Give us our daily bread" applies to spiritual gifts too. The little daily support for the daily trial. Life has to be taken day by day and hour by hour. Well, I never knew a man who so carried out his own advice. C.S. Lewis took life day by day and hour by hour to the full. C.S. Lewis then is our subject, and I want to speak to you as one quite outside his academic circle, as an ordinary person with no special qualifications, save that he called himself my friend. I want to share with you some of my memories of the late Professor Clive Staples Lewis, Master of Arts, Doctor of Literature, Doctor of Divinity, Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, Fellow of Magdalen College, Oxford, and Professor of Medieval and Renaissance Literature at Cambridge University. I will begin with a confession. I find it difficult to do adequately what I have set out to do, not because there is little to say, but because there is far too much. He was my friend, my very dear friend, and I loved him greatly. That is not said in any sickly sentimental spirit, which he would have hated anyway, but as a simple statement of fact. Professor Lewis was very similar in many ways to the late William Edwin Sangster, the famous Methodist minister of the Westminster Central Hall. They both included me in their circle of friendship. They both treated me with affectionate comradeship. They both talked with me freely on a great variety of subjects. They were both dedicated and devoted disciples of Jesus Christ, and they both desired passionately to let others see and know what it means to be a real Christian. But I had a somewhat closer relationship with C.S. Lewis, and when he was taken from us, I suffered, as did so many others, an irreparable loss. Like Dr. Sangster, Dr. Lewis was a man to whom one could go in any sort of trouble and be sure that one would receive everything that could possibly be given in Christian love, understanding, and helpfulness. Lewis, like Sangster, was a dear man, a lovable man, a true friend, and a splendid companion. Professor Lewis, like Dr. Sangster, was a Christian warrior of the highest order. Nevertheless, I find it difficult to speak about him because I have so many memories of an intimate nature, which must not be told. I can only draw an outline when I want so much to fill in all the details. I miss him so much. There have been many, many occasions since his passing when I would have consulted him, when I wanted, above all else, to hear his voice and see his smile, when I have wished for his wise and loving counsel. But he has gone from us, and we can, indeed we must, thank God for every remembrance of him. I'm not concerned today with the biographical details of my friend. He has told us something of his earlier days in his book, Surprised by Joy. And his brother, Major Warren Lewis, has given us a splendid outline in the letters of C.S. Lewis, which he has edited. His influence upon me has not come from his early days, nor indeed chiefly from his many writings, but from the days when I knew him personally, from the man himself, as I found him. Jack Lewis, and all his friends were invited to call him Jack, is a difficult man to describe. And although Chad Walsh, in his book C.S. Lewis, Apostle to the Skeptics, and Clyde Kilby, in his volume, The Christian World of C.S. Lewis, have both attempted it, the results fall far short of the reality. both Walsh and Kilby feel this and admit their difficulties. But I want a quote from both of them. Chad Walsh writes, "I understand what my friends meant when they said it was exceedingly difficult to characterize Lewis. It is not that his physical appearance is hard to put into words. He is medium height, stocky, has a very ruddy face with a network of fine veins just beneath the surface. His eyes are dark, and so is the hair that is now retreating from his forehead and has almost vanished from a large spot on the top of his head. Such are anatomical details. But to convey the total impression that Lewis leaves with you is much more difficult. His most striking characteristic is the aliveness of his face. His expression changes, lights up as he talks or listens. He has a quick smile which I would call sweet, if the word did not have too feminine a ring for one of the most masculine persons I have ever known. No one seems to have instructed Lewis in the formal art of public relations. I never detected him pausing to phrase a reply carefully for fear it might be used against him. If I mentioned prominent names, he commented on them with matter-of-fact candor, whether favorably or not, and did not add that this was off the record. When I inquired his opinions on a vast variety of matters, he answered with equal directness, though sometimes the reply was simply, 'I don't know enough to have an opinion.' It adds up to unselfconsciousness. One reason, I believe, is that he still has no conception of how widely his books are read and how very familiarly his name is bandied about. To the world outside Oxford, he is a famous figure. To himself, he is an Oxford don who writes an occasional book in his odd moments." That was written in 1949, and it is the expression of a friend trying to convey a picture of another human being in words that are forever inadequate. And Professor Kilby writes, "In a true Wordsworthian sense, Lewis was a lover of nature and solitude. When he walked, he refrained from smoking in order not to miss the full odor of nature. He described what he regarded as an ideal day. It would consist of breakfast at 8, study and writing from 9 until 1, with perhaps a cup of tea at 11. After a 1 o'clock lunch, there would be a walk, preferably alone, because talking blots out the sounds and silences of the outdoor world. If a friend went along, it must be a case of two bodies with but one soul, where a simple halt was sufficient proof that some image of earth and sky was shared. The arrival home at 4 o'clock would be the signal for tea, but now in solitude, with only some gossipy formless book that can be opened anywhere. From 5 until 7 there would be more work, then the evening meal, and afterwards talk, lighter reading, and bed at 11. Lewis's antipathies were in a few instances quite pronounced. He had little use for newspapers, which he believed created taste for vulgarity, untruth, and sensationalism, and the habit of fluttering from one subject to another without any discrimination. He hated collectivism of every species, and seemed in particular to enjoy pot shots at the inequalities of the British income tax. He had little good to say about what he called modern education, by which he meant that in which the old verities are scrapped in favor of laxness, experimentalism, chronological snobbery, and busyness. Our world, he said, is starved for solitude, silence, and privacy, and therefore starved for meditation and true friendship. He thought that perhaps half of all the happiness in the world comes from friendship. Not the artificially stimulated friendship of organizations existing for the purpose, but friendship generated among a few people brought together to do something that they like in common. He was always on the side of the unadjusted man, and of sales resistance to slick advertising, and everything else that leads to a bland, jejune existence. He favored the common man over the intellectual snob. In general, he was fearful of authority, even religious authority. There are few things he eschewed more than pride, especially pride masquerading in religious or psychological attire. All his life, Lewis waged a battle against pose, evasion, expedience, and the ever-so-little lie, and wished with all his heart to honor the truth in every idea passing through his mind. He finally accepted the Christian religion rather than any of its modern surrogates, some of which he had sampled and believed a while, but found unsatisfying. Now, all these words form small snapshots of the man taken from slightly different angles. Good, but neither the complete picture. Well, I suppose that isn't really possible. Witness the essays in a book called Light on C.S. Lewis. And I will not be so foolish as to pretend that I can do it. But I do want to add just my own personal touches to those snapshots, if I can. When I was first asked by my Carhartt predecessors to take the car and meet Professor Lewis, it was to be at Oxford Station. I'd never seen him before, and they told me to look for a portly gentleman who would be wearing a thick overcoat and a trilby hat turned down all round. He would also be carrying a walking stick, would have a haversack on his back, would be wearing horn-rimmed glasses, and would look like a prosperous farmer. That was a good few years ago, and after that first meeting I was privileged to drive the prosperous farmer some hundreds of miles, enjoy with him some hundreds of conversations on all kinds of subjects, and share with him scores of times of fellowship over meals. When I first knew Dr. Lewis, he was a fellow of Magdalen College, Oxford, and the journeys he required me to do for him were mostly local ones. Then he occupied the chair of medieval and Renaissance literature at Cambridge, and his journeys were to and from that university town at the beginning and ending of terms, and to and from Oxford Station when he came home at weekends. So you see, I saw him and enjoyed his company every week. There were also, of course, the other odd occasions when he and Mrs. Lewis went out to dinner, or to see friends, or for drives in the country. Unfortunately, ill health forced his premature retirement, and then I did not see him quite so often. C.S. Lewis is best known, perhaps, for his popular books of Christian teaching, the Screwtape Letters, Mere Christianity, The Problem of Pain, and many others. He has in all a great many volumes to his credit, including some written for children and some space science fiction. Naturally, you will find some of his books on my shelves, several of which he gave to me, and which bear his cordial regards and signature therein. I remember one of my friends seeing one of these books one day said, "Oh, so you know C.S. Lewis. Do tell me what he's really like." That, as I have already indicated, is no simple task. Dr. Lewis has been described as one of the greatest Christian apologists of the last 100 years, and as one of the most witty and penetrating thinkers of this present century. The Screwtape Letters is the most popular of his books, and I think that Mere Christianity might come a close second. Here are a few sentences, taken at random, the kind of thing that you will find in his work. "Until you have given up yourself to Christ, you will not have a real self. Nothing that you have not given away will ever be really yours. Nothing in you that has not died will ever be raised from the dead. Look out for yourself, and you will find that in the long run only hatred, loneliness, despair, rage, ruin, and decay will be yours. But look out for Christ, and you will find him, and with him everything else thrown in. All that is not eternal is eternally out of date. I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I can see it, but because by it I see everything else. Don't bother much about your feelings. When they are humble, loving, brave, give thanks for them. When they are conceited, selfish, cowardly, ask to have them altered. In neither case are they you, but only a thing that happens to you. What matters is your intention and your behavior. Yes, I am impressed by his writing. I am impressed by his concise and logical reasoning. I am impressed by his cogent arguments. But I am more impressed, simply because I have been in a position to be more impressed, by the man himself. What was he like? Well, Clive Staples Lewis was a Christian gentleman. I say that now, and I shall say it again at the end. Having been converted from a very real atheism to a very real Christianity, he was a man who knew what he believed and was ever ready to give a reason for the hope that was in him. If he was discussing religious matters or the various Christian denominations or theology or the individual Christian, it would be in exactly the same manner as he wrote about these things. There would be no platitudes, no shallow optimism about the world getting better and better. There would be nothing stereotyped. Whatever he said would have a welcome freshness, a new viewpoint, an attractive difference of approach, opening up avenues for further exploration. If he was speaking of ordinary everyday matters, you would find that, as in all his conversation, there was an exactness and a precision in all that he said. In fact, if he knew you well enough, he might suddenly pull you up for some looseness of expression. For example, I remember one occasion when I was driving him through Oxford, and somebody suddenly dashed into the road, immediately in front of the car, and we had to stop pretty sharply. I muttered something about these blessed pedestrians, and the professor straight away took me up on the expression. He began to inquire the exact meaning of the word blessed, and further, what the word meant as used by me in those particular circumstances. He looked at me with that well-known twinkle in his eye, and he said, "I suspect that what you really meant was damned pedestrians, just the opposite of what you said. You certainly didn't mean that you hoped they were very happy now, and that presently they will enjoy the bliss of the celestial realms." Oh yes, he could be very academic, he could be very professor-ish, but on the other hand, and I hasten to adjust the balance, he could be also, and usually was, the truest of friends, the best of companions, the most excellent of conversationalists. He never talked religion, except in the sense that a real Christian never talks anything else. I very much enjoyed our drives to and from Cambridge. After Dr. Lewis died, I wrote to his brother, and I have kept the letter he sent to me in return. In it he said that Jack often spoke of me with affection, and that those journeys to and from Cambridge were among the greatest pleasures of his latter years. I'm so glad to know that. If it was in winter time, we generally found a snug little inn somewhere on the way and had a meal there. If it was in summertime, we generally took sandwiches and picnicked where we fancied. I made a little personal pilgrimage not long ago to a certain tree and a patch of grass surrounding it, not far from the Bedfordshire village of Clophill. Jack and I sat under that tree a good many times and ate our food and talked, and I felt a strange desire to go and see the place once more. So I went, and I stood under the tree, and I looked at the grass and the bracken and saw the same old cottage in the distance. And I felt very near to my friend as I lingered under our tree that day. It was on one of those picnics that the Cambridge Don lost his hat. Now, there are many stories about this famous hat, and Major Lewis recalls one of them in his memoir, prefacing the letters. He writes, "His clothes were a matter of complete indifference to him. He had an extraordinary knack of making a new suit look shabby the second time he wore it. One of his garments has passed into legend. It is said that Jack once took a guest for an early morning walk round Addison's Walk after a very wet night. Presently the guest brought his attention to a curious lump of cloth hanging on a bush. 'That looks like my hat,' cried Jack. Then, joyfully, 'It is my hat,' and clapping the sodden mass on his head, he continued his walk." Well, that same hat was lost on one of their picnics coming back from Cambridge at the end of a term. On the way to Cambridge at the beginning of the following term, we looked inside the field gate where we'd picnicked, and there was the hat, under the hedge, being used as a home for field mice. Oh, Jack retrieved it, and later continued to wear it. Sometime later on, that same hat spent a few nights under the front seat of my car. And the very last time I drove the professor, the same hat sat squarely upon his head. Dr. Lewis was a great lover of the natural scene, and he was always delighted to go through Woburn Park, where the herds of deer and other animals come wandering down to the public highway, and where, in its season, the magnificent rhododendron drive is a sight to behold. It was on one of these Cambridge journeys that an amusing incident took place. We had called at a little wayside inn, which shall remain nameless, for a midday drink and some bread and cheese, and the landlord's wife, a very highly made-up and peroxided female of uncertain age, addressed Jack several times using the word ducks. After we came out, I noticed that there was a smile playing round his lips, and he said, "You know, Morris, there must still be something about me. Did you notice that that good lady called me ducks 3 times in as many minutes?" Well, I might go on talking about Professor Lewis for a very long time and still not give an adequate picture of the man himself. I often found myself envying his students, for it must have been an inestimable privilege to have had such a lecturer. Every point made with careful accuracy, so that there could never be any possibility of mistaking the meaning, the voice always clear, the pronunciation distinct. I once had to take him to Cambridge for just one lecture, and then bring him back home again, and he invited me to sit in, which I did with great interest and pleasure. He began by going over all the preliminary ground already covered for, as he put it, the benefit of the weaker brethren, but he put the point in such a way that the weaker brethren would have been eternally grateful to him for his consideration and kindness. This clarity and distinction was also manifest whenever he spoke on the radio or TV. Some of our public speakers and some of our preachers might well take a lesson from the Cambridge Don. Jack Lewis loved a joke, either to hear one or to tell one. He often related humorous stories to me during our drives together, and I have seen him roar with laughter many times over some little thing I thought would amuse him. He often laughed at my own propensity for suddenly delivering little bits of out-of-the-way information. One day I noticed on the side of a Harris sausage delivery van the words, "Established 1770," and I remarked on this and then said, "So Mr. Harris began making his sausages in the year that George Whitfield died." Jack burst into laughter, and then he said, "You know, Morris, if I met you on top of the Alps, I should expect you to tell me that John Wesley or somebody preached a sermon there or did something there. He was never dull. He was never dull." The only time I have known him morose was when he was not feeling up to the mark, and which of us is not a bit edgy at such times, it was then best to keep quiet and not attempt to engage him in any conversation. Oh yes, and I might also add this, I have known Jack Lewis to be very wide awake indeed when he appeared to be fast asleep. I shall always consider myself fortunate to have been included in his circle of friendship. This I valued tremendously. It has meant a very great deal to me, more than I can ever put into words. And I want to say this deliberately. Jack Lewis was the greatest man I have ever known. He was never, as Professor Kilby said, an intellectual snob, and he was willing to talk with anyone on any subject at any time, having the ability to put the other person at their ease. In the book to which I've already referred, Light on C.S. Lewis, one of the essayists said that Lewis always took good care that he performed or contested on ground of his own choosing. And another said that he was a formidable character. Well, that's all rubbish. I would most heartily disagree with both those statements. His learning was formidable, but not the man himself. He was one of the most approachable men I've ever met. He was willing and ready to talk about anything with anybody. I have been with him in the company of Oxford and Cambridge professors, learned and intellectual men, and I have overheard some of their conversation, conversation that I personally was totally unable to understand or share. But I have also been with him, sitting in the middle of a crowd of lorry drivers in a transport cafe, while he enthralled them, and that's not too strong a word, enthralled them with his wit and his conversational powers. After one of those occasions, one of the men came to me and said, "Hey, mate, who's the governor?" And when I told him, he expressed surprise, and then he said, "Blimey, he's a toff, he is, a real nice bloke." When I told Jack about this afterwards, he took it as a compliment, and I was glad because I think it was the greatest compliment I ever heard paid him. C.S. Lewis was indeed a toff and a real nice bloke. I have never known his like, anywhere or at any time. I remember that I once wanted to speak to him about something that was in the nature of a very personal and delicate matter, and he must have sensed my diffidence. I shall never forget, never, how he turned to me, how he smiled at me, and how he then said, "My dear old Morris, friends can say anything to one another and know that no confidence will be broken." His written words, so deservedly popular, and his spoken words to private individuals, so remembered and cherished, were given freely, but not without care, and should be looked upon as precious indeed. Some of his books I was acquainted with from the stage of their writing, and one or two of his manuscripts I had the honor of putting into typescript for him. I was also instrumental in introducing him to the works of the great Alexander White, the Puritan preacher of Free St. George's, Edinburgh, and this fact I see he has graciously acknowledged in his posthumously published volume, Letters to Malcolm. There were occasions when Jack used me as a kind of sounding board, a guinea pig, when he was trying out some new idea, or some new way of putting an old idea, or some fresh outline, or even some striking phrase. As we might be sitting over a glass of beer, or as we might be quietly driving along, he would suddenly say, "Morris, how does this strike you?" Or, "Listen to this and tell me if it means anything to you." And if I didn't catch on at once, I have known him to scrap the whole idea, phrase, sentence, or whatever, and start all over again from another angle. He took tremendous trouble to say in plain words just what he meant, and it was always an imperative duty with him to write good English as concisely as possible, coherently, forthrightly, leaving no loose ends, evading no difficulties, dodging no awkward questions, using a persuasive argument which in the end would convince and satisfy. Readers of his work must judge as to whether he succeeded in this. Oh, there are so many memories of him that come to me as I speak to you now, some of which may be told, some of which will never be told. On one occasion, I went to fetch him back from the Ackland Nursing Home in Oxford, where Mrs. Lewis was at that time a patient. When I arrived in the driveway, I saw him pacing up and down, slowly, deliberately, with his eyes upon the ground, utterly oblivious to anything that was going on around him. I sat in the car and waited for a moment or two, and then he looked up and saw me. He came straight to the car, and as he got into it, apologized for keeping me waiting, and then he said, very simply, "I was just saying my prayers." He told me afterwards that he often prayed in this fashion while walking or waiting anywhere, and once I remember at the beginning of a journey to Cambridge, he asked me not to speak to him for a little while because he wanted to say his prayers. I shall always remember, too, the night that Mrs. Lewis died. I've not said much about Jack's wife because this is chiefly about him, and I did not know her until after they were married. He himself has said that, marrying late in life as he did, he was fortunate to find in his latter years what he had missed in younger days. Joy Davidman was a very charming lady with a brain that matched his own and a great sense of humour and fun. As Major Lewis has said, she was a woman of great charity, with unbounded contempt for the sentimental. Setting herself high standards, she could laugh at the seeming absurdities to which they sometimes carried her. With all this, she was intensely feminine. Yes, she was, and she suffered from cancer. They were married at the bride's bedside in the Wingfield Hospital. They both knew that she hadn't long to live, but they were allowed what I can only call 3 years of unbounded happiness together. She died in 1960, and that night they telephoned me from the Radcliffe Infirmary asking me to go down and fetch him home to Headington Quarry. It was very late, and I was the first person apart from the hospital staff to see him and speak with him after Joy's death. He didn't want to go straight home, and so we sat in the car and talked for a long time. We talked about the things that friends do talk about on such occasions, and I shall always count it a privilege to have seen and shared in some measure his Christian faith and confidence, both of which were so manifest behind and beyond the tears of personal grief and sorrow. Afterwards, Jack wrote a little book called A Grief Observed, and here are some words from it. A good wife contains so many persons in herself. What was she not to me? She was my daughter and my mother, my pupil and my teacher, my subject and my sovereign, and always holding all these in solution, my trusty comrade, friend, shipmate, fellow soldier. My mistress, but at the same time all that any man friend, and I have had good ones, has ever been to me. Our grandfather's generation went very far astray. All that sometimes lifelong ritual of sorrow, visiting graves, keeping anniversaries, leaving the empty bedroom exactly as the departed used to keep it, mentioning the dead either not at all or always in a special voice, or even, like Queen Victoria, having the dead man's clothes put out for dinner every evening. This was mummification. It made the dead far more dead. For me, at any rate, the programme is plain. I will turn to her as often as possible in gladness. I will ever salute her with a laugh. The less I mourn her, the nearer I seem to her." So the bereaved husband wrote, as he remembered the days that were gone. The theologian Kierkegaard, speaking of his own writings on the Christian religion, said, "I firmly resolve to employ all my powers in the defense of Christianity, or at any rate to present it in its true form." And that, I think, is exactly what C.S. Lewis tried to do for many years, and in many volumes, and in every possible way. I once heard him preach in St. Mary the Virgin Church, Oxford, and it was an experience I shall never forget. The great building was packed from floor to ceiling. Many people were sitting and standing in the aisles and on the window ledges, and the title of the sermon was "The Weight of Glory." I would ask you to listen to some of the closing words. "In the end, that face which is the delight or the terror of the universe must be turned upon each of us, either with one expression or the other, either conferring glory inexpressible or inflicting shame that can never be cured or disguised." I read in a periodical the other day that the fundamental thing is how we think of God. By God himself it is not. How God thinks of us is not only more important, but infinitely more important. Indeed, how we think of him is of no importance, except in so far as it is related to how he thinks of us. It is written that we shall stand before him, shall appear, shall be inspected. The promise of glory is the promise, almost incredible and only possible by the work of Christ, that some of us, that any of us who really chooses, shall actually survive that examination, shall find approval, shall please God. To please God, to be a real ingredient in the divine happiness, to be loved by God, not merely pitied, but delighted in, as an artist delights in his work or a father in a son, it seems impossible. A weight or burden of glory which our thoughts can hardly sustain. But so it is. Perhaps it seems rather crude to describe glory as the fact of being noticed by God. But this is almost the language of the New Testament. St. Paul promises to those who love God, not as we should expect that they will know him, but that they will be known by him. It is a strange promise. Does not God know all things at all times? But it is dreadfully re-echoed in another passage of the New Testament. There we are warned that it may happen to any one of us to appear at last before the face of God and hear only the appalling words, "I never knew you. Depart from me." In some sense, as dark to the intellect as it is unendurable to the feelings, we can be both banished from the presence of him who is present everywhere and erased from the knowledge of him who knows all. We can be left utterly and absolutely outside, repelled, exiled, estranged, finally and unspeakably ignored. On the other hand, we can be called in, welcomed, received, acknowledged. We walk every day on the razor edge of these two incredible possibilities. I tell you, it is a serious thing to live in the society of possible gods and goddesses. To remember that the dullest and most uninteresting person you can talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship, or else a horror and a corruption such as you now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare. All day long we are, in some degree, helping each other to one or other of these destinations. There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are mortal, and their life is to ours as the life of a gnat. But it is immortals whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit. Immortal horrors or everlasting splendors. I know that this idea of the divine in man, the image of Christ in every man, was an ever-present idea in the last years of Jack Lewis's life. He spoke about it often, and it goes a long way towards explaining his attitude to other people, especially those who were his inferior in learning or intellectual capabilities. I don't think he ever looked down on anybody, and he was always willing to learn from anybody. It always seemed to me of great pity he did not preach more often, until I learnt the reason for his reluctance to do this. He told me one day that after he had delivered a sermon and had received the kind words and congratulations of all and sundry, as always happened when he spoke in public, he began to think what a jolly fine and clever fellow Jack Lewis was. And, said he, I had to get to my knees pretty quickly to kill the deadly sin of pride. Jack Lewis ministered to all of us, and there was always healing in his touch. We shall not look upon his like again. Jack and I talked together, drove together, laughed together, wept together. He was my friend. And when he died, I wrote a little memorial poem in which I tried to express my feeling of utter loss and desolation. My own words I prefaced with four lines from William Watson's poem, The Glimpse. Here are Watson's words. Just for an hour, you crossed my life's dull track, put my ignoble dreams to sudden shame, went your bright way, and left me to fall back on my own world of poorer deed and aim. These were our feelings, carved indelibly within the poet's words when you passed on and left us here much poorer, sadder, and so sore bereft by this so great a loss. So you, my friend, have gone upon your own bright way, and I have never missed a dear friend more. I miss your face, your voice, your smile, the twinkle in your eye, your presence at my side. My teacher, too, has gone, for you were one whose words I valued highly above all the teachers I had known before, but now I do not wait outside your door. Professor C.S. Lewis, just a name to some, but you to me were sometimes Sir, and sometimes Jack, and sometimes Dr. Lewis, as varying circumstances might dictate, but always, always my companion and my counselor. My trusted friend, you never failed me once, nor did you ever let me down. You met my need. But now, now you are in truth gone far upon the brightest way of all, a gallant Christian warrior indeed. And we, who knew you well and loved you much, are poorer, sadder, and so sore bereft by this so great a loss. I said earlier that C.S. Lewis was a Christian gentleman, and that is what I've been trying to say all through. It must suffice. I have tried to show you something of the man as I knew him. He thought so little of himself and did so much for others, not only by his speech and in his teaching, but in secret charities and in other unsuspected ways. When I think of him, and I do that very often, when I think of him, I remember the face, the voice, the smile, the clear-cut arguments, the calculated precision, the fun and laughter, the persuasive eloquence, the rugged exterior of form, and the vast intellectual power and drive. And I always find in my heart a great and loyal affection for my revered teacher, my invaluable counselor, and my dearly beloved friend. We, who knew you well and loved you much, are poorer, sadder, and so sore bereft by this so great a loss.